What's going on, trail runners? Welcome to another episode of the Coopcast. I'm your host, Jason Coop. And today on the podcast, we're going to talk all about strength training for ultra runners. I know it's that time of year where people are thinking about maybe getting back in the gym, maybe bulking up a little bit, maybe doing some exercises to help prevent injury. And there is a lot of misinformation and confusion around this area. And so what I did is I actually pulled in one of our newest coaches, Sarah Sicorzo, and I promise you I will butcher her name way worse than that in future editions of the Coopcast because it's just hard to pronounce and I'm not very good at it. But I pulled in one of our new coaches, Sarah, who actually has quite an extensive background in this area, having worked with some professional sports teams that we talk about on the podcast, as well as within her own personal interest. We talk about a lot of areas, and what we really tried to set up during the course of this podcast is strength training the right option for you to achieve the goal that you want to achieve, whether that is improved performance, whether that is you just like it, you just like to do strength training, or whether you're trying to prevent injuries. And what we decided in the middle of the podcast, and this is actually quite fascinating, is we're going to make it a two-part series. So this first part, what I want the listeners to really focus in on is strength training the right outlet for you to achieve whatever goal that you have? And I think that we painted that picture quite well. And then in the second part of this podcast, which is going to come out maybe 1 or 2 weeks after the first one, we're going to really dive into the nitty-gritty programming elements of what a strength training program might look like should you decide to undertake it. So we had a lot of fun with this. We pulled a tremendous amount of research in advance of this. And we actually start the podcast out with just kind of some dialogue about what that means and how that's changed over the years and really how hard it is to find kind of the right combination of papers and research and literature that's out there to point coaches and athletes in the right direction. And so much so at times you can hear us like filtering through some of the papers that we were referencing throughout the podcast. So we started out there, but really the conversation transitioned to this overarching dialogue of, is strength training something that is right for you to actually partake in? So without any further ado, have a listen to Coach Sarah and I on, is strength training right for you? So I always ask coaches whenever they have good research framework, meaning they know how to actually like pull research. Mm-hmm. What's that a product of? Cause trust me, I've trained and I've developed and hired like hundreds of coaches. And so I see all of the different patterns of how they look up and pull research. And it's very, very clear. I mean, you have some coaches that come in that they're doing everything that they can and they're trying to do the right thing and they're trying to like be well thought out and well researched, but they just don't pull the right papers. Like they just don't perform the information gathering step correctly. So they're pulling like small studies or really bizarre things because they fit a certain search term or whatever. But when you pulled all this stuff, I was like, yep, that's exactly what should have been pulled. So I was just wondering, like, where does it come from?
Yay. I don't know. I honestly, the funny thing is I couldn't find, like in my email, I was trying to find studies more on the corrective stuff, which I couldn't find. Yeah. So it was more of like, well, you know, let's go with what most people associate, you know, strength training and ultra running. And there aren't many of them. So then it was like, well, let's go to distances that are as close to that as we can get with studies that are large enough. Cause you don't want to just do 10 people.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that you can't find a lot of research specifically on the corrective training.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that has to do with everybody calls it something differently.
That's a good point.
And we've talked about that a lot just in our own like internal continuing educations that that sometimes we tend to use these big broad umbrella definitions or this big broad umbrella vocabulary for things, and they don't really, they're not really the same thing, but we don't have a better way to describe it.
Agreed. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I, it's funny because in my notes here too, I even kind of said that, you know, with strength training, it was like, well, we kind of like, let's define that and what we're going to be discussing today in terms of strength training for ultra runners, because it's such a broad brush, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah. And then I tried to look for studies that were more recent than like 20 and 30, you know, you get these ones that are like from 2003 and 2002, and that's not to say they're not good, but let's see if we can find things that are a little bit more peer reviewed and more recent.
No, I appreciate that. Like I said, it's not, and that's a correctable skill. Like whenever I've had coaches that have come in the door and I say, hey, you know, go research X, Y, and Z, and they just come back with garbage, like that's a correctable skill, just like any other workplace skill. And we work on that with those coaches. But I'm always impressed that when we have coaches kind of right off the bat that kind of know what to look for and know how to for it and how to pull them and how to interpret it, which is a completely different different thing, right? I mean, it's so easy just to go right to the conclusions and go, oh, well, these are the conclusions that the research team made, so they must be the conclusion. But then, like, when you combine the conclusion with the methods and then the statistics that went into it, so...
Or just read the abstract on the first page and don't even read the conclusion. You just skip right ahead. Yeah, and I think, too, what a lot of people, the challenge some people run into is they only pick the studies that they think will back up what they want to prove. Yeah. And I think it's good to look for ones that don't, because you need to see that side too.
Well, that's super easy to do nowadays, because we get a lot of what to look up just through social media, and social media is like the ultimate confirmation bias lens. Because it feeds you more of what you like, right? Because they want the apps to be sticky. But also, just as humans, like, we tend to follow and like and seek out people that are more like us.
And then it feeds us more of that because of the algorithm. So you get more of that. Yeah, it's true.
Well, I mean, you know, we actually used to have our interns like actually pull the physical journals. And like an exercise that I would have them do is like just like literally like photocopy, you know, these seven things in this journal that we got out of the, you know, couple dozen or so journals that we would get every month or every other month. Go ahead and photocopy out these, you know, these studies, and then we're all going to bring them together around a table and discuss them. And there you're really truly kind of getting a representative sample of what the research is kind of presenting out. Now, the way that information is disseminated, which is essentially Twitter, you know, for anybody who's not in the academic space, it's Twitter. I would say anybody that's kind of in the practitioner space, right? The academics, they'll still get all of the journals and they'll pour through them and things like that. But the practitioners, like the coaches and a lot of the physical therapists and even the RDs and things like that, like their information source on the research side tends to come through that social media platform, because that presents it's the lens that you give it. Right.
Yeah.
And it's
confirmation bias. This is what I believe. And here, this confirms what I believe. And there's,
Anyway, that's a whole nother, I should find an expert on that topic to really,
that would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Cause I don't think people think critically. And I think so many people are afraid to be wrong, because to be challenged in your own belief makes you question, you know, it's not comfortable.
Totally.
And it's okay to go, wow, maybe I was wrong about that.
Yeah.
Let's look at it from a different angle.
Totally. I've found I have to work really hard to keep a balanced perspective when I'm like, when I'm using social media to like weed through relevant information. Like I have to intentionally unfollow people that are just putting out nonsense or in a lot of cases, like just perpetuate the exact same point of view. And I have to intentionally follow people that have a different point of view. And that's not easy. Like, that's an easy statement to make, but just to like actually go through and do it, I've actually found it professionally really challenging.
I bet that would be. Yeah. That's a good challenge though. Yeah.
Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. I do appreciate the research that you pulled. And since you had a hard time finding the research that was more in your sweet spot, Sarah, I think that let's start with that, because you've got this really cool background that I kind of really appreciate. And I think there might be some like little funny anecdotes that go along with it, that you can tell working in a professional league sports team, kind of at the top of the food chain there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you want me to kind of go into that background?
Yeah. Yeah, then? Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So, I worked with the Cincinnati Bengals for 4 full seasons and a little bit of the last season before they did a coach changeover. and my primary role with that was I was a consultant working on kind of restorative exercise in the sense of like injury prevention and correctives. I'm not huge on that word. Gets a lot of flack sometimes, when people throw on correctives as if someone's doing something wrong, but we'll just use that word. Yeah. We'll use the word corrective. And I worked with the players on I got to work with every player on the team, which was really cool, all positions, and just kind of individually worked with specific issues they may have had, and then worked with them in group settings as well on ways to kind of balance out their bodies with the demands of their playing.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people think of football as the exact same sport for all the players. No, it's absolutely not. No. I mean, you've got not only, players on both sides of the ball, but you have skill players, you have huge offensive linemen, you have very fast players, you have very skillful players, and kind of the whole run in between. And so in essence, like when I look at that through a coaching lens, you're really not coaching one sport. You're really coaching like 5 or 6 different nuances within the same like umbrella sport of football. But to get a little bit deeper into like what you're actually doing, since we've already agreed that the vocabulary isn't very good.
Yeah.
Like take the listeners through from a realistic, practical perspective, what the prescription looked like with the players that you were working with. Like what types of exercises were you taking them through? What were the different conditions of the players and things like that?
Yeah, obviously, not getting into specific players and injuries and things like that. Yeah. So when I would work with we'll use foot health, for example, which sounds so like that's not strength training, but they tend to have very weak feet and they tend to have, they wear really tight cleats when they play. So they tend to have very weak feet. You don't think of that, you don't think of feet in football players, but we worked from foundationally from the ground up. So we would literally start with foot conditioning, strengthening the foot, working on ways to work out the fascia in their feet, the tight spots, how we strengthen those feet. And then we'd go up through the chain, calves, knees, hamstrings, hips, and we would do different, both stretches, but also more actual movement type exercises to activate and help balance out the weak spots. So that's what we were going for, is the weak spots, because these players are very good at what they do. And depending on what position that is and depending on their body type and size. But you'd be really, really amazed at how much generally players lack in certain areas.
Well, yeah, because we kind of laud these professional athletes that are out on the field. I mean, the Super Bowl just happened, last weekend, and that's like the pinnacle of that sport, obviously. But we tend to laud these athletes as these like superhuman, types of people that can, run faster, jump higher, lift more weights than, anybody else out there. But what a lot of people kind of lose sight of in the hype of the sport is that they're actually real humans and they have deficiencies in their athletic game, just like any other athlete that's training for a marathon or a 5K or whatever has a deficiency in their athletic game.
Absolutely. And I think it's kind of neat for people if they realize that, because you see these people on the screen and you think they're almost superhuman, But in fact, they have issues too. They have plantar fasciitis. They get IT band issues. They get hip things. They, you know what I mean? So it's, they're still a human body playing at a level above most what of us will ever see, but it's still a human body. And if the human body has deficiencies and weaknesses in certain areas, it doesn't matter if you're an NFL player or a weekend warrior, things are going to pop up.
Well, and you probably saw them at their worst.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd see them at the best in the beginning of the
sure.
season.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then by the end, it's strikingly different.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard sometimes too, because you see these 23-year-old guys like not moving like 23-year-old men anymore, you know, by the end. It's a rough sport.
Yeah. That's such an awesome, such an awesome perspective to like bring into endurance sports. Cause you know, there are a lot of parallels. I mean, endurance athletes are kind of notorious, and we kind of put an S on our chest, proverbially speaking, because of all the hard work that, you know, that we put in. And it is a heavily injury ridden sport. You know, there's a study that I pull up a lot that, you know, kind of analyzed the trends of runners over the course of an entire year. And they found that, you know, almost 70% of those runners missed at least one day of training due to an injury. And I've presented that in our coaching group before, and they just kind of look at it and go, well, the other 30% are lying. Like it's everybody.
I think everybody has, right? I mean,
sure.
I think those other people aren't really being forthright, because everybody has something pop up. And for some people, it's just a really small little thing that doesn't take any time and they're back at it. And other people, it can be season ending. It can, you know, literally their race season is gone.
Yeah. So you've got this perspective where you see these like really big or really fast and really athletic dudes on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They've played a game on Sunday, beaten the snot out of each other. You see them Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You're trying to get them kind of back in the field to play, not only for the next week, but the week after that and the week after that. But along that same time, you're also like a pretty badass ultra runner. Like you were doing a lot of pretty cool, like ultra running events at that time. Did that ever like come in to the, you know, to the training room or to the weight room or anything like that?
They thought I was insane. They're like, you're crazy.
You're
they
the insane
were like, you are. Yeah. I was the crazy one. They're like, no, that's awful. They're like, we don't run. I'm like, but you run. And they're like, no, we don't run like that. They're like, why? A couple of them thought it was super cool.
Yeah.
They really were like, that is awesome. I really think it helped me identify with them more because I had a sport. I had something that I trained for and I was passionate about, and they could, even though they didn't understand wanting to run 100 miles, they could totally respect what goes into something like that. The commitment involved.
Sure. It gave you a little street cred.
Oh, total street cred. They would be like, oh my God, the girl crazy. they would be like, then a new guy would come in and they'd be like, you got, what do you do? Tell him what you do. Like they just thought it was hilarious.
That's hilarious.
But they were generally, you know, interestingly enough, most of my events were in the off season, like the summer, you know, where they were kind of on break. So I'd work with them like April, May into June, and then they'd be off and then you'd start back and when the season started. So like Leadville and Never Summer and July, August. So I'd come back and they'd be like, what'd you do now? What did you run? What did you do? And I wouldn't say I'm badass. I'm just really, I'm good at being persistent.
Well, but the funny thing is you don't, I never told you this, but when I was screening all the resumes that for the incoming coaches that we had, I saw that and I paired two and two together. I paired like the athletic side along with your job side. And I painted this picture in my mind of, you know, the players coming in on Tuesday or Wednesday, and you also coming in on a Tuesday or Wednesday after some event, and like these comparative war stories of the football game on the player side, and then your ultramarathon on your side. And I just came up with this hilarious scene in my mind. And I just realized I never talked to you about it. So I'm glad that scene is at least somewhat validated.
It is. No, that's funny. And I appreciate that because it really was, you know, especially if I was like sore after a particular run or event and I'd come, you know, come in and they would be beat up and we'd be like, oh, what's tight with you today? You should have seen the other guy. But yeah, so it was fun to be able to to be able to relate in a different way, but still fatigue and recovery are kind of universal.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that's a really good point. That's a really, really good point. So now, I mean, you, with that experience, and you've been, you know, working with runners, and you've been a runner that entire time, but now you get to take a lot of that experience and a lot of that practice of working with athletes that are kind of at the pinnacle of their, not kind of, they are, they're at the pinnacle of their sport. And you get to apply some of those same principles to runners. How do you go about doing some of the same things and kind of like sizing up a runner and saying, okay, these are the things that we're going to work on from, I'm going to use the word that you don't like, from a corrective exercise, you know, point of view.
Yeah, I don't mind it. I just know some people get all
I do too, because I don't like, but you know, it's the vocabulary that we're stuck with. But how do you go about doing that for like a trail and ultra runner? Because that's like your world now.
Yeah, no, and it was then too, and so it's very relatable, you know. But so in the sense of like, if I get a runner in front of me, or I get a new athlete that I'm working with, like how do I?
Yeah, either way.
Yeah. So because I do both, I work with people, you know, in person, and my athletes remotely. So we'll go with the remote option,
sure.
Kind of now. So generally, you'll get someone in. And, you know, when we have our conversations and we do our questionnaire, and it's just kind of like, hey, what are you doing? What's your injury history? You know, kind of what are your weaknesses and areas that you want to improve? And just also kind of getting a feel for what they're doing in their day-to-day life. Because most athletes, your everyday athlete also has a job. They have a family, they have other things going on. So they might run 1 to 2 to 3 hours on a given day, but then they might be sitting at their desk the rest of the day. They might be, you know, there might be some other thing they're doing, a repetitive motion in a different way. And so not to paint a generality, but a lot of runners, especially if they have a desk job, will just focus on the running. And then they will go and sit, and they tend to be very weak in their posterior chain. Again, I'm painting a broad brush here, but I don't like their glutes aren't firing. Your glutes are firing. They're just not, maybe, you know, there's an imbalance there, or there's a weakness in your lateral hips, or there's hamstring tightness, or you've got some hip things. Maybe your feet are weak. And so I try to work into their strength training ways to kind of balance that out.
But I like the fact that you're sizing up the athlete. You're looking at them, and everybody's always going to come into coaching for both general and specific reasons. The general reasons is they usually have an event lined up, but the specific reasons are I have this one thing, this one like little niggle that I can't fix, or I can't, you know, solve my nutrition, you know, program, or something kind of very, very narrow. And I think what I'm getting from you is that the athlete's telling you that really specific thing, hey, my knee hurts. It's really easy to go and zoom in on, okay, what's going on with the knee? Let's try to quote unquote fix this like acute problem of the knee, but you're backing up and saying, okay, what are you doing for work? What are you doing for life? What are you doing for stress? And using all of those different inputs to start to create like an exercise program for that athlete.
Correct. Yeah. I don't just take it as, oh, you're a runner. This is what you're, you know, and just go from there. It's like, okay, yeah, you're a runner, but you're also, you do this or you do that. Okay. So you've had, and again, scope of practice, I'm not a physical therapist, so I don't diagnose and I can't, you know, treat in that aspect. But if someone may come to me and they're like, I have a history of IT band problems. I have a history of this. And it's like, okay, well, what have you been doing? What, you know, let's explore what potentially led to that. Because generally, there are some pretty, I don't want to say easy, there are some simple ways to help with the general, simple does not mean easy.
Correct.
So there are some simple ways you can address common issues that runners and we'll say specifically ultra runners are facing. Whether or not it's easy, you know, is another question as far as doing the work and really kind of cutting down the layers of what we're working with. But generally when a runner, an individual starts, you know, incorporating some of these correctives into their programming, they start to see improvement because they're actually activating and using muscles and, you know, their body in a way they may not have been, because trail running has an advantage. Running is pretty repetitive.
For sure.
In the plane of motion. Trail running has an advantage because you're, you know, rocks and jumping here and kind of laterally shuffling there. It's a little bit different. But as a whole, it's pretty repetitive over and over and over again. So one little chink in that armor of movement can really have a domino effect.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we've talked a little bit about what to do when you know something's wrong. And we've also talked about the fact that that's just about everybody, right? Because everybody gets injured at least once a year. But before we dive too far down that rabbit hole, and this is going to start to set up the framework for the rest of the conversation. There's this other side of strength training that a lot of runners are also, and including myself as a coach, is also really fascinated by. And that's really strength training as an ergogenic aid, meaning you're strength training very specifically to get a performance improvement. Now, you could say that the corrective side of the strength training world is also ergogenic because it will keep you it'll keep you less prone to injury, right? You're not going to be as prone to injury. And then therefore, because you have more training availability throughout the course of a year, that then can improve your performance. But there's another piece of the strength training side that says, we're going to strength train very specifically to get some sort of physiological adaptation that will therefore improve performance.
That's usually people will cite running economy and VO2 max.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say.
It's usually what people will throw up.
Exactly. And that is a totally different prescription than the quote unquote corrective side that we were just talking about. And I know that you have done a lot of research and you've done a lot of practice on this side of the strength train, on the ergogenic side of the strength training equation as well. So let's go there next and start to talk about first, what are these specific kind of physiological improvements that we're getting on the ergogenic side? And then the second thing, just very, very broadly. And then the second thing is, what does the prescription generally look like? Because what I'm then going to do is compare that prescription to the corrective prescription to kind of paint the picture that they're very different.
Yeah, no, they are. And so when most people, there are a lot of, when runners think of the performance side of strength training, you tend to get more of the power and strength. So your 1 to 5 reps, 1 to 5 sets, depending on, you know, what study and, you know, what you're looking at, of lifting, you know, very, very high, heavy of your 1% rep max. So it's very heavy. It's intense. You need more time in between sets for recovery. The whole idea is to strengthen the body. And this is very, very broad. You can go so deep with this, but generally speaking, strengthening the muscles, the connective tissue, to get that strong, elastic kind of response in the muscles. And people will then argue, or not argue, they will say that will then help with running economy.
Yeah. And I think that's very well teased out in the literature. Yeah. And we pulled a lot of literature before this. I don't know if you guys who are listening, you can hear all of the papers being flipped every now and again. We probably have about 5 or 6 different studies in front of us that we're going to reference from time to time.
I destroyed a small forest.
That's okay.
Destroyed a small forest.
I'll plant a tree later today, and we'll be all good.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. that's my point with that is that's very well teased out in the literature. If you have some reasonable strength training program, reasonable is in air quotes. If you have a reasonable strength training program where you're lifting heavy, and heavy being a set of 5, a set of 6, maybe times 2 or 3 or something like that, that's hard, challenging for the athlete, and or fast ballistic types of movements, plyometric movements, box jumps and things like that, you have one or both of those components. Almost any study that you look at, you'll see improvements in economy. And if they measure a performance improvement, you'll also see an improvement in performance as well. I'm going to take a timestamp at 29 minutes. Is that coming from, is that sound coming from your side? Oh, it's your cat. Okay. We'll just wait for a second.
I'll try to get him to shut up here. Let me sprinkle some treats out for him. Do you want me to,
No. Just let it go. I might actually leave this audio in here just to make it more real.
No, that's okay. He never does that except when I'm on the phone and it's like, wow, I need love. No, Do not include that in the conversation.
Sarah's cats might make a, might make an appearance on the podcast.
Please
again.
Please don't.
No, it's okay. Don't be embarrassed. Trust me. Sasha's interrupted way more than I actually released to the world. Okay. So let's kind of recap that again. So the primary argument for strength training as an ergogenic aid, as it relates to running, relies in the fact that you're going to be able to improve your running economy. That's the primary one. That's not the only one. Before everybody starts yelling at me, not the only one.
Yes, it's the primary one. It's one of them.
But running economy tends to like rise to the top of the heap almost in all of these studies. And the conduit or the programming conduit to that is very heavy weights relative to the athlete. Relative to the athlete, going back to your football analogy, they were lifting way, way heavier weights than our skinny little runners are. Heavy weights and or fast ballistic types of movements.
Correct.
That's the conduit there. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that those types of training sessions are hard.
Correct.
And
they if programmed appropriately as programmed, they should be. That's the stimulus. That's the reps and sets guide, you know, based on the percentage of one rep max. That's the goal.
Yeah. They should be hard.
They're hard.
And so there's an amount of training stress that the athlete and or the athlete and coach need to take in mind with the entirety of all of the other training stresses and life stresses that there are. And it's 100%. It's not insignificant.
Correct. I would agree with that.
Okay. So now that
we're on the same page.
Yeah. So now that we've painted that picture, you can get a performance improvement with this type of strength training using strength training as an ergogenic aid.
Are we going to talk about the amount of improvement?
That's good context. Yeah, Sarah, go ahead. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, most of the studies that we see, you're getting maybe 2 to 4, 3 to 4%.
That is right? A good point.
In running economy and VO2 max. So you're a track athlete. Oh, go ahead.
Keep going where you're going. Sorry.
I was going to say, what is important for people, I'm probably getting ahead of myself. But is that 3 to 4%, that 2 to 4%, you know, the studies usually find it around that range.
Yep.
How much is that going to make a difference in an ultra marathoner how much is the cost benefit of that is my point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think and we can talk about what that is, but I think your point is it's a few percent, not 10 or 20 or 50.
It's not a significant percent. Yeah,
would be in the eye of the beholder, right?
It means exactly, that's true.
If you finish Western States underneath the 30-hour cutoff by 2%, and that's the difference maker, then hey, there you go. But I think that the correct picture, and thank you for stopping me before we went on to point this out, is that the magnitude of improvement is typically along a few percent. And it doesn't matter. You can look at the actual economy improvement or the VO2 max improvement or the performance improvement, which is always what we're primarily concerned with, the performance improvement. That performance improvement typically lags a little bit behind any one of those individual markers. And this goes both inside and outside of strength training. You can look at a nutritional intervention. It's the same thing. You improve VO2 max by 4%, and then maybe the actual performance improvement, depending upon what the performance marker is usually less than that by 1 or 2 or 3% or something like that. So my point is when we see these, hey, you improve your VO2 max by 4%, the actual implication to the athlete isn't the full 4%. because right. performance is multifactorial and you're only measuring one, or you're only kind of like measuring against one aspect of that performance. But suffice it to say, as a summary, let's kind of go through our big points as for strength yeah. training as an ergogenic aid. It has to be heavy and or fast.
Yep.
The training load is relatively high. It's a hard session.
Correct.
And the improvement that you're going to get is on the order of a few percent. Yep. That's a
correct.
That's a good stylization of that without spending 5 hours on this
which
podcast.
We could easily do.
Okay. Okay. So all the listeners have that in mind. If you want to use strength training as an ergogenic aid, you're lifting heavy and or you're lifting fast, and you might get a few percentage improvements. And here's another thing that's worth mentioning. You might just like it.
Exactly. I love strength training.
Yeah.
So I'll own that right out the gate before anybody throws tomatoes. I love strength training.
Well, John asked me the other day, he's like, Coop, you've been in the weight room a lot. And I'm like, yeah, I've been in the weight room a lot. He's like, how do you feel? I'm like, well, physically I feel great. Cause I always feel great. I'm a little bit heavier because I put on like 10 pounds of muscle and I'm slower uphill. that's all I can notice.
Yeah. And I don't know, you know, I'm sure we're going to circle back around to this, but you know, if you like doing it,
awesome.
But if you're doing it to improve your ultra marathon running, that's where I think we're going to kind of dive deeper here in terms of your cost benefit of doing it.
Yeah.
And how is that balanced with your volume and intensity of your running
yep.
that you're doing?
That was my point. Is my strength training right now is in no way, I have no way designing it as an ultramarathon or ergogenic aid is because I would just want to go in the weight room. Curls for the girls.
It's that midlife crisis thing. I get it.
I know. We're both 41. Okay. Let's move over to the quote unquote corrective side of it.
Okay.
And why don't you go ahead and paint the picture for what that type of prescription looks like?
Yeah. So from a corrective exercise standpoint, it's going to be, when I say I'm using air quotes for my higher reps, it's higher reps than one to five is the point. So it could be 8 to 12, 10 to 12. It also could be time. Some things we do for 45 seconds, like your favorite monster band walks, things like that. We might do for 12 in one direction and 12 in another direction. Things like, I know, I couldn't resist. So there are certain things, but the point is I don't ever go personally. I don't do the like up to 20 rep.
Okay.
You'll see that, or people are using like a 2-pound dumbbell. That's just not how I design my program.
Or like swing their arms in a running motion for 2 minutes.
Oh, I definitely want to talk about that later
too. Okay. Yeah.
Well, not necessarily that, but how people try to mimic running in the weight room.
Yep. Okay. Yeah.
You're going to get better at running if you run and then do the accessory stuff that'll help support that running. It's less skill-based. A lot of those heavier weights, you have to be very, very, especially the ballistic movements involve a lot of skill to do. Would you agree?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a lot.
That's an advanced move.
There's a lot more room for error. Whereas the corrective is going to be less intense. You can do it more often, and it's really not going to pull away in general from, if done correctly, from your running. It should add to it, not detract from it, is the point that I try with my athletes.
So it's higher rep, lower weight, lower overall training impact. And let me see if you agree or disagree with this little bit of stylization. It's focused on usually correcting certain movements. And so therefore the corrective exercises tend to be like more precise. So on the ergogenic side, it's a squat, and on the corrective side, it might be some sort of really specific hip exercise.
Yeah. Or even something like a lateral step up but we're not doing it to max weight, you know, but we're trying to engage, or a pelvic lift or some way. Yes. You painted that picture correctly.
Okay.
That it is definitely, we're trying to correct certain movements. So it's very specific in that movement that we're looking for.
And the goal of which
is
to keep people in the field of play as much as we can.
Yeah.
So you're going to test these people before and after in a typical research setting. We go and we test their running economy and their VO2 max and their pace at lactate threshold and maybe some performance marker. the outcomes of those interventions, when you test them before and afterwards, I would say are much more nuanced, or you can't even tease them out before and afterwards.
Yeah, I could agree with that.
It's so point, yeah. So instead of having a magnitude of 3%, it's a magnitude of 1 or maybe not, even or maybe not even statistically
you're
not significant.
Injured.
Yeah, you're not injured, right? That's
you're
the,
not
that's
injured.
The,
I mean, that's
that's the point I'm trying to paint. When we're looking at the ergogenic side, we can do some testing and say, okay, the athlete is a few percent better across these parameters. When you do it in a corrective setting, that type of testing becomes, are you less injured?
Correct.
And the magnitude of that, and I think this is super important, the magnitude of that quote unquote less injured piece, and we're going to stylize that a little bit. We're going to stylize this a little bit because when you dig through the literature, it's impossible to weed through all this stuff. But the magnitude of the injury prevention side is actually quite remarkable. I mean, it's 50%.
Yeah, it's definitely higher than the other numbers we're getting from the ergogen. Yeah,
exactly. So when you look at the situation and say, okay, you can incorporate strength training specifically as an injury prevention aid, and you're getting numbers that athletes are spending 50% less time being injured or whatever other kind of categorization of injury you want to use. Typically, it cuts it in half, which is actually quite remarkable. And if you think about that from a practical standpoint, you're injured or you lose maybe 10 days of training a year for a reasonable runner, right? You lose 10 days of training a year because you're dinged up, you're injured, you got to take a day off here, a day off there, whatever. If you're able to reduce that by half to 5 days a year, that's actually a lot of training availability that you've then just gained because of whatever intervention. I would say that that's marked and almost more marked than the ergogenic side. I don't know what your opinion on that would be.
No, I agree with that. I mean, and I think there is I will kind of interject this, that I think there is a role. I am not anti-lifting heavy. My view is there's a place for it in a training cycle so that ergogenic, 3 to 5 reps at high, close to your one, within your 87 to 90% max is great in the off season. But what I like to focus on, we were just talking about, that can be done throughout the whole season if done appropriately during your actual training.
Yep. So,
yeah.
So, 100%.
You don't have to shelve it. And there will be people that say, no, I still lift heavy and I run great. And I'm like, yeah, but for what return? And what are you potentially sacrificing in terms of rest and recovery? And those are hard sessions on those legs. And your body, stress is stress. And whether it was a hard run or a really hard session in the gym, your body still needs time to recover. And a lot of people think, oh, it's my rest day, I'm going to go lift because I'm not running.
I love that. I love it.
You know what I mean? So I'm resting. And I'm like, no, but there are so many things going on when you lift heavy like that.
Yep. That let's put a pin in that and remind me in like 10 minutes to come back to the heavy lifting is not rest piece of it. I want to still kind of go down. I still want to, now that we've painted these two categories, and we're going to call them, since we're just making up words, we always make up words, we're going to call them the ergogenic category, that's the heavy and fast category, and we're going to call it the corrective category, that's the more repetition and lower impact category. What I want to do next, and I'm going to give you a second to start to internalize this, so I'll go first, is give like an example program of each. And I'm going to leave you actually to the corrective side all yourself, because I know that you can come up with that off the top of your head. But on the ergogenic side of it, I'll paint a quick picture of, if I just had a generic athlete, the things that I would have them do, and then you can kind of either say, well, you might want to substitute this for this, or you can kind of give a completely different program. Cool.
Okay. Cool.
So on the ergogenic side, put your thinking cap on. Since I asked you to do this off the top, we didn't plan this out in advance. So on the ergogenic side, if I had a new athlete that wanted to include strength training, they were the right candidate for it. We went through this like work rest, equation that we're going to kind of come back to later. I would have them start out with 2 or 3 sets of 5 across a few different exercises, and the two to three, you could probably do a coin flip, but if they didn't have any experience, I'd keep them at two and then move them up to three sets. And if they had some experience, you could probably just start them out at three. But I would have them do a push, a pull, a hinge, a carry, and then some sort of dynamic core exercise. I hate using the word core. That's why I paused right there. So I got stuck
in your throat.
I know. I was like, anyway, that's another topic. So the push, I just have them do a dumbbell bench press 3x5 at something that they felt pretty darn tired at the very end. The pull, lat pull down, or an assisted pull up. What did I say? Push, pull, hinge, and carry.
The hinge,
I'd have them do a simple squat or step up. 3x5. Squat can be with a back bar or a trap bar. Trap bars are hot now. Why are trap bars so hot now?
Oh, they're just the new thing du jour. They've been around forever, but I love trap bars.
I know, but everybody's using trap bars now. So
who doesn't feel badass holding a trap bar?
Yeah, I think that's it. You're absolutely right. It feels more badass because you're picking it up off the ground versus like lifting it up off of a rack. So for the listeners that don't know, so a normal back bar is just a straight barbell. You know, it's sitting up on a rack. You can either bench press with it or squat with it or do a deadlift with it or whatever, but it's just a straight bar. A trap bar is it an octagon or a hexagon? It's hexagon. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hexagon.
Yeah, hexagon.
Yeah.
So it's a hexagon with the ends of the bar, just like you would see a normal straight bar where you'd put the weights on, and you step into this hexagon, this metal hexagon, and you pick it up by handles. And so you're kind of like actually inside of this metal contraption. And to Sarah and I's point, you kind of feel like a badass when you step inside of it and then you pick up these handles and lift it off the ground. So maybe that's it. There's some sort of psychology to the trap bar and why it's
hot. Could be.
So my point with that is the hinge could be a squat and a trap bar. People like the trap bar.
A deadlift.
Or deadlift.
Yeah.
That's also a hinge. So we've got dumbbell bench press, a lat pull down, or an assisted pull. I say assisted pull up because most runners couldn't do 5 pull ups to save their lives.
Correct.
I can do eight now.
Pull ups?
Yeah. Full extension. Yeah.
Eight. Listeners, I think we need video proof of this.
I'll do it next time I go to the gym. I'll go to the gym on Mondays. I'll get video proof.
There we go.
So that's the pull. The hinge is a squat. Well, you just leave it at squat. Most people are familiar with the squat. And the carry, I like carries because it's a little bit of a dynamic core exercise. Mm-hmm. Just carry around a heavy kettlebell for 20 meters, switch arms.
Farmer's carry, right?
Carry it to the other side. And then
here's another buzzword.
Yes.
Functional. Oh, that's God. Functional that's, core
let's,
work.
Yeah. Let's not get that.
We've got three words now so far.
So that's my carry is just a typical farmer's carry. Pick up a heavy weight, stand up straight, walk 20 meters, switch it to the other hand, walk the other 20 meters. And the other dynamic core piece is I just like the standard wood choppers. That you either do with
a medicine ball or a cable?
Either one. Yeah. I personally prefer the cable if I can get the rope ending to the cable. I don't like the handle ending to it because it just like torques my wrists around. And plus, like grabbing a rope just feels badass.
Badass. Again, it's all about feeling badass. that's why the battle ropes
are so popular. It's because they just feel badass. But anyway, those five exercises, the push, the pull, the hinge, the carry, and then the dynamic core exercise are the five that I would prescribe. That entire run of show, doing 2 to 3 sets of five for any athlete is going to take maybe 30 minutes, maybe 35 if you're being really lazy and you're constantly going back and forth to the water fountain or whatever, you're watching SportsCenter on the TVs in the gym or whatever, maybe it takes you. But my point is it's not a lot of time. If I had an athlete that had a reasonable strength training background, I'd have him do a box jump. I might add that on there after a couple of months, but I would start them for 8 weeks, 2 sets to 3 sets of 5 repetitions of those exercises with appropriate rest of those simple exercises, and I would just call it a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's not necessarily sexy.
No, it's not.
And that's where the problem lies for a lot of people, because then they want to start doing all these other things, which don't really, they can do things, but again, at what cost to the running?
Okay. So let me ask you, what variations on that could you possibly suggest?
Yeah, I would make sure. So if you're doing a squat, I would like to include like a single leg exercise in there.
Okay. Yeah.
Like a, don't get me started on pistols, but like a step up, you mentioned that, mm-hmm. but, or a Romanian deadlift, mm-hmm. a lunge is a great exercise.
And would you do that in addition to the squat or in substitution of, so you're adding a different exercise.
I would add. So if you're doing a squat, I would do like a reverse lunge, because that's going to be a more hip and glute dominant version of a lunge.
Yeah.
So your squats work everything, but a traditional squat, and now we're going to be doing back squat or front squats or goblet squats or, but a reverse lunge is going to kind of pull more into that posterior chain. As far as I wouldn't do a front lunge at a squat personally. You can, but I just, if we're gonna bang for a buck,
I totally agree with you on the reverse squat, like, or reverse lunge,
reverse
sorry
lunge.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on the reverse lunge. It's also easier for most people to grasp, like, once
it is.
Usually it's like two or three reps of awkwardness because they're going backwards and they're not used to working in that plane. But after that, and they're like, okay, I can kind of be aggressive with my foot and like move my foot quickly backwards, and then I've got the motion, then they're fine, and it puts them in a better position.
Well, that's what I was just going to add. Most people, they do a front lunge incorrectly because they go forward and they have that shearing on their knee. They're coming off the heel on the front foot. A reverse lunge kind of takes that out of the equation. They're stepping back, so they're really getting that step back, drop down. So they're getting more of that glute engagement, and they're putting their knee, if they're susceptible to like patella tendonitis or things like that, anything like that, usually puts their knee in a better position. They can usually put themselves in a better position, I should say.
I saw somebody a couple days ago in the gym pair a reverse lunge with an overhead press. So she was holding, it was actually a kettlebell. She was holding a kettlebell in her left hand and doing a reverse lunge with her right foot going backward at the same time. I'm like, oh, okay, I got it. Like,
and that's an offset. So what she's doing there is it's anti-rotation. Yep. Your body's fighting the rotation. So it's like, again, bang for your buck, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she was an MMA fighter, so that's a totally different.
There's that too.
Yeah, so I wouldn't advise that for a runner just getting into it. So we've got this kind of basic set of exercises. You could probably take a couple of variations off of those individual exercises, but a push, a pull, a hinge, a carry, and then maybe some other sort of dynamic, you know, core exercise is a good foundation to start out with. And I would make the blanket statement that if you did that for 8 to 12 weeks, you would see some performance improvement by the end of that time, if you could accurately measure it. Most people don't have a way to do that. They do a time trial beforehand, time trial afterwards. But I think I don't think it's an unreasonable leap of faith to say, if you're able to keep that up alongside all of your other training, and there's the caveat that everybody needs to listen to that we're going to come back to. If you're able to keep that up alongside all of the other training, you'll see a reasonable yet small performance improvement.
Correct. I would agree. I think we can agree on that.
Awesome. Okay. So that's the ergogenic side. Let's move back to the corrective side.
Corrective side.
You're the expert here. You go.
Well, so sometimes a corrective doesn't necessarily look different in certain ways. So there might be a squat involved, because squats, I believe, are good for everybody if done correctly. But it might not be a barbell squat. It might be a goblet squat. It might, you know, these studies usually just tend to do like, we're going to grab a barbell and we're going to do all these things, but then it'll usually include monster band walks or lateral step ups or core work that is needed. Hip opening work, where, you know, things that, and that, again, it's very specific to the athlete. But if somebody has an issue right now, let's say with they've gone to PT, they've got patella tendonitis, they've got issues with their knee's sore a lot because they've just got that there, right? They've been cleared to work out, but it still is like a little niggle. Okay, then maybe working on more posterior work and not focusing on the squat right now for you, we need to focus on, let's do some reverse lunges. Let's do Romanian deadlifts. Let's do a lot of glute bridges. Let's work on where you need to correct your imbalances. Because again, painting with a general brush right now, everybody's individual. But if you're very quad dominant and weak in your glutes and your hamstrings, there tends to be a relationship in that knee that we need to work on.
And here's where one of the key differences starts to come out. So on the ergogenic side, we say, listen, you can use these five types of exercises and you can almost universally apply them to runners and they're going to see some benefit. Yeah. And I, you know, there's going to be somebody that slings an arrow or throws a tomato that says, well, you know, you need to individualize it for this or individualize it. You're going to hit 90% of runners that don't currently strength train with either those five exercises that I mentioned or some variation of those. And it's really not going to make that big of a difference. The bigger difference is actually going to be on the programmatic element or where it actually gets programmed, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Yeah. On the corrective side of it, it does, from what you were just saying, it does have to have a very individualistic approach because you're trying to like use the words that we're trying not to use, correct, quote unquote, correct something. Like you're looking at like some deficiency or some sort of imbalance or some sort of specific weakness. And we're saying, we're going to go and target that.
Yes. So the traditional, I need to say traditional, but the ergogenic, the one we first explained, like you said, you can throw it and 90% of the people will see a benefit of it. Correctives, generally, if you don't need it, it won't hurt you. Mm-hmm. Generally, there are some hip rotation things. If you're really externally rotated and we do too much external rotation work, i.e. getting the lateral hips to, you know, you can cause, that's a whole nother rabbit hole. Yeah. But generally speaking, but the general strength program that we first described won't help the people that need the correctives. So that those correctives are going to be that piece that really unlocks things for them.
Yeah.
And it's very, very, it's much more individualized. What you need to work on correctively, air quotes, may not be what I need to work on.
Yeah. This is where I go, just go see a physical therapist, go see a good quality physical therapist, have them get some eyes on you, have them kind of assess the situation. And if they come back with something, then we can design programming around that alongside with what the physical therapist is actually doing. But like, I don't, as long as I've been coaching, I don't have the eyes to look at that.
Well, and it's also, you know, a lot of personal trainers and strength coaches, sometimes, I shouldn't say a lot, but often people will go outside their scope of practice. Yeah. We are not here to diagnose.
Yeah.
I can generally say, well, runners tend to have these issues. So if you're a runner and I want to make sure you don't have that issue, here's some things we can do. But when it comes down to the actual, you've got this problem, it's best to go see a professional, get a diagnosis, know what we're dealing with. And then we can build a program around that to help better work with that. Yep. So there are some generalizations in the correctives, but it's only a generalization in terms of what runners tend to. It's more specific than just do a squat.
Yep. Okay. So it's,
if that makes sense.
Yep. So let's try to paint a broad brush across those types of exercises. They're highly individualized. They're higher rep. They're lower. They're lower intensity, meaning you're moving around 10, maybe 10 pounds, right? 10 pounds of resistance versus 50, 60, 80 pounds, 100 pounds, 150 pounds of resistance on the ergogenic side. What I'm trying to get is just less. The intensity is less.
Yeah.
The resulting fatigue is less.
And it's going to be 70% of one rep max or below. I mean, it's not going to be the high rep, one close to one rep max that you get in the other.
So the picture that I'm trying to paint with that is there's not a huge physical cost to those types of activities, although there's a time cost to them. You still got to spend time doing them.
Correct. That's it.
As compared to the ergogenic side, there is a high physical cost to doing, and there should be a high physical cost. Otherwise you're not getting the ergogenic benefit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Agreed. 100%.
Okay. So we've got these two kind of two categories painted And this is kind of how I come down to strength training when I look at it. And we've just spent, you know, an hour kind of going over this. Like, I think that's a really good impression of the situation right now. One of the reason that people are doing strength training from an athletic perspective is, as we mentioned earlier, they're using it as an ergogenic aid, or they're trying to remain uninjured. We've quantified the ergogenic aid as a few percent. And we've quantified the amount of injury improvement that you can get, which is basically your training availability that you improve, by roughly 50%. So you get injured 20 days out of the year, maybe by incorporating some sort of smart strength training, you reduce that 20 days.
Smart strength training. We'll call it that instead of correctives.
Oh, gosh. Smart strength training. I don't know if that quite call your bar, your standard there is pretty low. So where was I going with that? Oh, yeah. So on the injury prevention side, if you're missing 20 days a year due to some sort of injury, I think you should reasonably expect, if you do some sort of smart strength training, you reduce those number of days to about 10. So you're just getting more training availability. And that's a proposition that I'd take. I'd always take that with an athlete.
Yeah. Yeah. So
here's my alternative, right? So here's my alternative. And in an effort of full disclosure, I had about in training essentials for ultra running, I had about, it was almost 10,000 words. So to give you scope, like the whole book is like 100,000 words, maybe 120,000 words or something like that. I had maybe it was 8,000 words. Anyway, I had a whole section of the book dedicated to strength training, and the book got too big.
And something had to go.
And I reduced a lot of things. And one of the things is I took the strength training thing and I reduced it to a 500 word sidebar.
And
I got the crap kicked out of me in the Amazon reviews, which if you can get the crap kicked out of you in an online review,
Are you even an author?
And it's not to say that what I wrote was incorrect. I just didn't give it enough space to kind of give the position justice. And I've learned from that. That's definitely an error that I made in writing and kind of crafting the book. And fortunately, I have time to correct that. Right. I mean, the second edition is coming out, you know, later in the year. And that's definitely an area that I'm going to expand upon. But part of the nuance that was lost when I cut that down is what we're going to talk about next. And that is there's an alternative to achieve these ends of having an ergogenic aid, improving your running economy, improving your performance, and at the same time reducing your risk for injury. And that alternative is rest.
I was going to say, hold your kombucha, folks. Here we go.
I know. It's rest. It's not lightning. It's not anything magic.
It's
not sexy. It's not a super, you know, pill that you can take or anything like that. It's plain old rest. And when you look at rest, once again, just to paint the picture and compare it as an ergogenic aid and also as an injury prevention piece of it, you know that when you rest the next day, you're going to perform better. We do that with races, right? You rest before a race, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 days, whatever it is. And that race then becomes your kind of ultimate performance. So it acts as an ergogenic aid in that way. You get better, higher quality performances out of the training. And then those training improvements that you get compound over the course of time. And in all of the literature that Sarah and I pulled kind of in advance of this talk, the common theme for the intervention that is used is they compare two groups that are doing the exact same training. And what they do is they add strength training on top of whatever other training that they do. That's normally, not always, but normally the way that the intervention is set up. You have runners that are doing 40 miles a week and they're doing one interval workout or whatever. You split off half of those runners and then you add a strength training component, therefore increasing the overall total load, and they see some sort of benefit either from the strength training specifically or from the workload increase due to the strength training specifically. But my point with that is that on in this first category that we talked about, the ergogenic category, since it's hard, it's not rest.
Correct.
It's mutually exclusive of rest.
Yes. And we can say it's fun. We can say that people like to do it. We can say all these things, but you can't say that it's rest.
Correct. And that's the first thing that I want people to keep in mind when they're trying to determine if strength training is right for them, is if they're going into this heavy lifting category, if they figure out that that's the right choice for them, it's certainly not rest. And it's actually mutually exclusive of rest. And somehow you have to look at the training load picture as a whole, how many hours you're doing, how much hard workout that you're doing, how many rest mm-hmm. days that you have, how many easy days that you have. And you have to look at the strength training as a, it's harder than an endurance run.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, because we talk about how we teeter totter intensity and duration, volume mm-hmm. and intensity, right? And then people will just throw in intense strength training workouts with no thought to right. how that affects the overall balance of what we're working on yep. at the time, because it's air quotes, not running.
Yeah. Well, and so once again, on the ergogenic side, since we're talking about a few percentage points improvement, you can very easily see how you can get that same few percentage points improvement just by incorporating more rest, resting smarter, to use that buzzword, resting smarter. And it's when you look at it intellectually as a performance enhancer, when you look at strength training intellectually as a performance enhancer, and you compare it with the rest that you have to sacrifice, it's hard to split the hair that finely and say which one's better than the other, specifically on the ergogenic side of it.
Agreed.
That's where I come to.
I do agree.
The second piece on the injury prevention side, and we didn't talk about this a little bit, but if you're using strength training primarily on the ergogenic side, big heavy weights and things like that we were talking about earlier, you do get injury prevention from that. That's been well demonstrated in the literature.
Correct.
Also. And the, yes. And once again, the magnitude of that is about 50% less days. I cite this study quite often, and it's because it's the best one that we have. It's not perfect. No studies are perfect, but it's on adolescent athletes. And they found that adolescent in this study is ages 15 to 35. So, you know, maybe you early 30. I know we're not adolescents anymore, but it's a wide variety of sports. It's kind of a meta study. It's a meta study. Several hundred athletes participate in it. And they found that the athletes that had 2 days of complete rest per week had a 5.2 times they had a 5.2 times less chance of injury. So that's 500%, not 50%, 500% less chance of injury than the other groups when you're factoring in everything else. And I use that as an example, not to say that everybody should take 2 days off a week, because there's a whole host of other factors that go into it. But I use it to say that if you're looking at any sort of intervention to prevent injury, the magnitude of those interventions are normally 50% is a lot, but it's not as great as 500%. Like rest has an absolutely huge effect on injury rates. Huge, absolutely huge, way more than any sort of thing that you can add to the training program and kind of including strength training. And so that's the second picture that I'd like to paint with the rest side of it, is that normally when you look at rest, there's a bigger effect from taking more rest as it relates to injury prevention than any sort of additive corrective exercises, strength training, and things like that. Now that's not always mutually exclusive. And that's what I want to talk about next on the corrective side of things. We can walk and chew bubblegum at the same time a lot.
Thank God.
I know exactly. And this is an area where I actually think you can. I mean, you can rest and use the corrective exercises, and perhaps there's a compounding injury prevention effect with both of those.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to add, because rest you can't argue with that. I mean, that's heads and tails above 50%, 500%. Yeah. That's not even like, you can't even like, well, it's a couple percentage. I mean, that's huge. Yeah. My thing with the correctives is when you get someone who, if they're really weak in their lateral hips because of their, whatever they've got going on in their life, the rest is not going to fix that. We need to balance the body out. So having those 2 days of rest is great, but they're still going to be dealing with what they've got. So if we can, 2 days a week, work on these other things that have very low cost to their training, in the sense of it's not stressing the body. It's pretty, you could weave it in pretty well and not have a big, the benefits in the cost, or I should say the cost is very low. Yeah. To what it's going to take out of the body.
You presented that brilliantly, that with a lot of the athletes that are getting injured because they have some sort of mechanical imbalance or something like that, the rest is probably not going to have as huge of an impact as 500%. It might be 0%, right? Because they're still going to come out of that rest with all the exact same issues that they had going into it. I think that the ideal solution there is you got to walk and chew bubble gum, right? You got to give it the right amount of rest compared with the correct corrective exercises from
the correct programming.
I was trying to make a cheeky joke, the correct corrective exercises from the Department of Redundancy.
If you pair
those two things up, you actually have a pretty winning combination, because the corrective exercises in and of themselves are not a high workload. And so you can incorporate them, and they're not necessarily going to impact the volume that you're able to do or the hard workouts that you're able to do. And to a certain extent, you might hate me for saying this statement, so please feel free to throw whatever shade you need to throw. But to a certain extent, like athletes who are trying to find their own way, there are a lot of self-coach athletes that are kind of like listening to this. The penalty for like kind of like stabbing in the dark on the individualization component of all of these corrective exercises, the real penalty for that is just their time.
No, I would agree with that, and potentially not finding what they need.
Yeah.
But the internet can be wonderful and awful in turns. And you can get great information that you can then learn to apply to yourself by just digging, deep dive and finding reputable sources. And then you can start adding a bunch of things to your programming that's not going to help you, but chances are they aren't going to hurt you. They're just going to cost you time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So quick summary of that, because we went off on a few tangents. If you're thinking about doing the heavy, hard strength training, specifically as an ergogenic aid, think about if you just incorporated more rest and which one is going to have the more impact. If you want to do hard strength training just because you love to do hard strength training, that's what I'm doing right now. I'd love to see if I can do 8 pull-ups in a row. I'll have proof of that by the time this podcast comes out. I'm already on the hook for it. If you want to do it just because you like doing it, there's nothing wrong with that. But you have to balance it out with the rest of the work that you're doing. And kind of coming back to my personal reference, I absolutely have taken hard workouts off the table because I'm tired from whatever I did in the weight room. I'm tired from the reverse lunges I did, or, grabbing the trap bar and, loading up a couple plates, which is a lot for me. I'm tired from doing that. And I've missed I've missed a few hard workouts just from, I'm just too over fatigued. I'm fine with that. I'm cool with that at this stage of the game.
And that's very personal. Yeah. There's no one to say that's right or wrong, but just know the cost of what you're doing and how it can affect your training schedule and cycle. Yeah. And so that's why, and like, when you finish your fall race and you've got the whole winter, that's a great time to dig deep, start doing this type of programming.
100%.
Have fun with it. Go 100%. For it. Feel like a badass. Yep. And then when you start ramping up for your races and your A races are coming, then throttle back and just back off a little bit, take more rest, do stuff that's actually going to help with some of the identified, maybe some weaknesses and imbalances that you've got. Focus on those and then rinse and repeat.
Let's do this, Sarah, for the listeners, because I'm sure a lot of listeners they'll like take this to heart. They're going to start hitting the weight room. They're going to do, 2 days a week or something like that. and they're going to, you know, do the push, pull, hinge, carry, other type of core exercise, or they're going to take a corrective approach, but they're going to want to know like how to actually layer it into their program. So let's do this. Let's agree. We'll do a follow-up and we'll kind of focus on the specific programming elements of it and go, okay, what's the right frequency? How do you modulate the intensity throughout the course of the year? And as the competitive season kind of comes into play, because that's worth another 90-minute podcast just right there.
Absolutely. More than that. Absolutely. Because that's where the magic happens, is knowing, it's again, just like your run programming, where to put specific workouts, where do you have your different phases of your strength training?
Well, and I see so many people, they do just what you mentioned. They want to feel like a badass. This is exactly what I'm doing. They want to feel like a real or perceived badass. They want to go, I'll go in the weight room until March or April or something like that. And then I'll just I'll be doing too much running in the middle of the summer and all that stuff will fall away. And there's a very good argument to be made that if you're looking at strength training through the lens of improving your ultramarathon performance and you stop it, all of those benefits that you just have worked so hard to get are going to go away in a very short order, 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks. I think that's a good follow-up. We'll go over the programming side, frequency, how to change the intensity throughout the course of the year and things like that. A lot of people are going to have questions. So if you want to do it right now, you know, it's February. This is going to come out like maybe the first week in March or something like that. You can get started. Do those five exercises, spend 30, 40 minutes a week. Pick the exercises, you know, go do them. You can do them at a high intensity because, you know, your overall training volume is pretty low right now, but you're going to have to modulate that as you go down the year. And maybe we can come back in like April and discuss how to modulate that. Cool.
I'd love to.
Awesome.
Cool.
Okay. Last topic. These are the things to avoid. And you get to pick the first ones. You can pick either just the silly crap that you've seen over the course of your professional career, or just to like poke fun at it and have a few giggles, or you can pick something kind of relatively serious that will have a profound impact on an athlete that is about to make that mistake.
Oh gosh, I could do both either.
Do them both.
I would say what to avoid before you jump in. And this is more for the new person who's maybe doesn't have a lot of strength training experience or it's been a while. Don't jump right into ballistic movements. And if you do learn how to do things before you start doing crazy ish, because you can
learn the basics first.
Yeah. Learn the basics. I mean, movement mechanics, learn how to move. You know, one of the things I see is people will load up. Okay. This is a big pet peeve. They will load up a bar to do a squat with a weight that's far exceeds what they should be doing. They don't do it properly. They don't do it to depth. Their knees are caving and everything's a mess. Yeah. And maybe they can't even body weight squat properly. Yeah. So maybe we need to start with the mechanics before we feed the ego with the plates and the weights and all of those things. Because if you groove a movement pattern and you do it well, then you can start loading that movement pattern.
I have a hilarious story about this. It kind of pokes fun at myself as well. So I went to a big track and field collegiate program, Texas A&M University. After I'd left there, they'd won, you know, multiple conference and national titles and things like that. But one of the odd things missing from that program were Olympic style lifts. We'd not do that at that program, which is becoming more and more common since I left the university system. I've just seen it kind of pop up more and more, and whether that's right or wrong is another conversation, but I've just seen it more prevalent. The point of that is I had no exposure to that prior to leaving university and moving up here to Colorado. One of my really early coaching mentors was a woman by the name of Meg Stone. And there's zero chance that anybody listening to this has ever heard of Meg Stone or her husband, Mike, but they are titans of the strength training of the strength training education platform in the United States. Meg was a former shot putter from Scotland qualified for, I think she went to two different Olympics. Anyway, great athlete. And she was kind of one of my early mentors as I was getting into coaching. And I very specifically remember one day she's working in this endurance coaching company as the strength training guru. And she, you know, recognized that we all didn't really know anything. And so she was going to teach the lot of us how to do Olympic style lifts, snatch, clean and jerk, things like that. And the way that she started with us is she just brought in a broomstick. So she had, you know, 15 different broomsticks. We'd all sit in our big warehouse and she'd go over how to teach the movements and things like that. And I could just not get it. Like I lifted weights, I'd done squats, I had great form across all like the fundamental movements and things like that. But when I put it together in an Olympic lift with a broomstick, I just couldn't get it. I looked like an idiot. Like I was, if I had any weight on the bar, I would have completely like hurt myself. And I was getting so frustrated that I just couldn't put these movements together correctly in front of Meg, who I respected a lot as a professional and who was really hard on me. Like she was really like in a loving way, but she was like, Coop, you got to get your shit together. Like you got to learn this stuff. Like, and that was true with a lot of my early coaching mentors, but her in particular, I just, you know, she just had this way of just being like really brutally honest. And so finally, after like 30 minutes of getting it wrong, time and time again, she just said, Coop, you know, if anything, you're going to be the example of how not to do it today. And that is your value in this whole exercise is you are the bad example. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to come back tomorrow and do better, Meg. Thank you very much. So I brought value to our whole 15 person coaching group by showing everybody how not to do it. It was awful. So anyway, I like to back up your point, like even if you have a reasonable strength training background and you're jumping into the Olympic style movements or the ballistic movements, you have to exercise a little bit of caution.
Hire a coach, hire a professional, hire somebody. Yeah. Even you can go to these centers and work with an Olympic weightlifting coach, have eyes on you one or two sessions where they can help evaluate and teach you the movements.
Yeah.
And then you can go from there. But why not learn how to do it correctly? Yeah.
So that's your movement. That's your thing to avoid is go
one
into
of
the
them.
One of them. Go ahead. You got more. Keep rattling them off. We got all day.
Oh no, no. Just really, I think it's really easy to get caught up on what people you see online and you see people doing. We've talked about this. You see LeBron James's trainer doing a really cool, fun exercise, and know if that has a place in your particular training, just because you might not be there. And it's fun to play. I love movement. I love playful movement. But realize where that kind of fits in with your particular training and your physical abilities.
Yeah. And the endurance space, Kate Courtney is going to be the one that everybody's imitating. She has a pretty badass Instagram game where she's flipping weights around on, you know, unstable surfaces and things like that.
And that feels like a badass when you do that.
She is a badass though.
Yeah. So she is a badass, but I try that. I'll probably kill myself. Yeah. So
for those of you who don't know, Kate Courtney, she's a reigning world mountain bike champion right now. She kind of has a home base out in the Marin area of California. Go check her out on social. She might just save the entire sport of cycling. That's how highly I think of her right now.
No pressure.
I doubt she's listening to this. Okay. Here's my thing to avoid. And it plays off an aspect that we talked about earlier, that if you're thinking about incorporating particularly heavy and or explosive and fast movements into your training program, take some training off of the table. Don't just add it into it. We mentioned all the studies that we looked at in kind of preparation for this podcast. The other common thing that they have, other than the strength training being additive, which is, it's not universal, but it's pretty darn close. The other thing that they all have in common is almost all of them are done on college age men who can handle that type of increase in workload much more easily than another population group, somebody in their mid 30s, or Sarah's raising her hand on the other side of the line, early 40s. I'm sorry to out your age, Sarah.
It's okay. We're in the same boat, Sarah.
Yeah, I know. But if you have, the point is very few people listening to this podcast are the same cohort as the cohorts that they're studying in these strength training studies, which are college age men who can adapt to training stress just better than us. Just fact, they're great athletes. They're at a stage in their lives where they can take on that training stress. So as a consequence to that, don't imitate the intervention. If you're going to incorporate particularly hard strength training, take some running off the table. It's probably not going to be that big of a ding to your overall improvement, but don't just layer it on. Don't just add it on willy-nilly, and that's just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why if some people have a hard time with that, that's why off-season and early season is a good time to do that, because they can pull some of their running volume off. They can, you know, swap something and not have this existential crisis or have their coach be mad at them because they're dropping a quality run out of their week or layering, you know. And so on a day when that's not such a good idea to do that.
You know, what's really interesting is whenever I've gone through this practical, okay, let's like walk through, are we going to include strength training? We have a discussion just like we've had. Maybe we'll shorten it by a lot. We'll shorten it by a lot. I'll give them like the 15-minute like nickel overview. Here are the two areas that, you know, we can kind of focus on if you want to do heavy stuff, if you want to do corrective exercises, blah, blah, blah. And when I come to the point of, okay, practically, here's how we're going to implement this. We're going to take Tuesday's hard workout and we're going to make it an endurance run. So we're going to take that hard workout off the table, and then we're going to plop in strength training instead of this hard run. Or we're going to manipulate the calendar in some other way that results in a reduction of volume and or intensity. When I present that proposition to add the strength training in, that's when the pushback comes, like, whoa, 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 whoa.
They don't like it.
Yeah, like, whoa, like, I don't want to, like, I'm doing 10 hours or 50 miles or whatever it is. Like, I have to do that amount a week. I don't want it. I just want to add this to it, to which then I go, okay, well, that's not how it's going to work, because you're already working out pretty hard. So you can't add stress on stress on stress.
Yeah, exactly. But again, people, it's not running.
Yeah.
Strength training. That's what people will come back with. It's not running. Yeah. Yeah. So they don't think of it that way, you know, until you point out, like, yeah, but your body is still feeling stress. It's still undergoing a lot of its stress with that type of workout.
I can't tell you how many coaches that I've talked to professionally that have told me some story about an athlete that they're working with that thinks that hard strength training is an appropriate thing to do for a rest and or easy day. Like, that is such a common, that is just such a common piece of feedback in the coaching. I just kind of laugh at it now. So athletes, if you're making that mistake, you're not alone, but stop making those mistakes.
Yes. And please don't start trying it like the week before an A race.
Oh, that's the, all right.
We're two not or three go. Weeks before a race. Don't do that.
Yeah, we're not going to go that on that rabbit hole, but suffice it to say, Sarah, we're going to come back in a few weeks. We're going to talk about, we'll get into the programming piece specifically. I know we offered a really broad brushstroke on the types of exercises, the frequency, and then how to like calibrate the intensity and what days to do it on and things like that. That's a fascinating discussion that we'll come back and do maybe in like 4 to 6 weeks time. But
that'd be great.
Yeah, we're going to put a pin in this right now. I think this is like really good for people to start to chew on, because a lot of people at this time of year are making this evaluation of, is this something that I want to start to incorporate into my workout routine? Do I want to start to do strength training? They're like just coming to that thought process right now. And I hope by listening to this podcast, they have enough to chew on that if they're self-coached, they can kind of go through those if-then scenarios and say, yep, it is, and then start to do it. Or if it's whatever reason kind of not in their favor, then they just can kind of, then they can kind of leave it on the table. But it's certainly a decision-making process that I want people to be thoughtful about.
Agreed. Absolutely. Because there are many benefits to strength training. But if you're just doing it for the performance enhancement for ultra running, there's a time and a place for that.
Yep.
And you gotta weigh that out.
100%. All right. Brilliant place to leave it at, Sarah. Thank you for your time.
I do my best.
Yeah,
thank you for having me. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you for joining all the way from Germany. I really appreciate it. And yeah, we'll do it again sometime, okay?
Sounds great. Thanks, Coop.
Okay, trail runners, what did you think? You have a clear answer on if you're going to incorporate some strength training into your routine? Is that answer yes? Is it no? Is it a big fat maybe? Was it not very clear? If it wasn't very clear, hit Sarah or I up on social media. We'd love to help you answer those questions. It is a conversation that we routinely have with athletes. If you can't tell from the podcast, everybody wants to ask, is it something that's right for them? And after we go through that dialogue, sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes it's no, and sometimes it's let's see, and let's just kind of see how you feel. But it is not always one way or the other, just like any other training aspect or any other aspect of life. As we alluded to during the podcast, we are going to do a follow-up, and that follow-up is going to be really detailed, very specific exercises, sets, rep, intensity, and even when. And I think this is actually one of the most critical pieces of programming in a strength training program, when to actually do those strength training activities during the week. We're going to have a follow-up podcast to discuss all of those things. If you want a specific question answered, you can reach out to me on social. I've put this out on Instagram and both on Twitter, or you can hit me up on either one of those platforms, and we will incorporate those questions into the podcast. We would really appreciate to get you guys' feedback on that. Appreciate Sarah coming on board. And also, I'd be remiss if we didn't thank our sponsors. No, wait, I'm just kidding. This podcast doesn't have sponsors. You guys know that. I don't take money from anybody, and that's all in an effort to keep it real here, keep it honest, talk about what I want to talk about. Thank you guys for listening. That's really what I wanted to say. Thank all of you to the listeners. You guys are really what makes this podcast shine. And it is what it is today because of you guys. So appreciate the heck out of you. If you have not already taken the opportunity to do so, go ahead and subscribe to this on iTunes and or give it a rating and a review on iTunes. I would really appreciate that. Love to hear from you guys. Love to see you out on the trails or maybe even in the weight room. Anyway, we'll see you guys next time. Have a good one. Peace out.